off with the next procedure. Okay, Dick. This gentleman has a 2-meter receiver, and he has found a discriminator location for the sample. He wants to know what type of cap this electrolytic should use and what size, and how should he couple that out to, say, a PLC connector so he can monitor audio from the discriminator. What value cap, what voltage, and should he use a coax wire or twisted? Maybe two words on that thing.
Yeah, when you connect directly to the discriminator of an FM receiver, you're connecting before it goes into its low-pass filter. Almost every discriminator has a low-pass filter, usually called the de-emphasis network. Because FM broadcast, as you get the signal weaker and weaker, and you're listening on your radio, FM receiver develops a high-frequency hiss. And in order to compensate for that high-frequency hiss, they do a what they call a de-emphasis network. It's a kind of an audio low-pass filter that attenuates the high-frequency hiss. So now the high-frequency notes coming from the FM receiver are weaker than the low-frequency notes. They compensate for that at the transmitter by making the high-frequency notes stronger. They pre-emphasize. So the transmitter has a pre-emphasis network between its microphone and the rest of the transmitter. The receiver has a de-emphasis network after the discriminator, before the audio amplifier and loudspeaker. So the advantage of picking off right at the discriminator, you're picking off the signal before the de-emphasis network, and if it's a high-frequency subcarrier that has been injected on the audio, like stereo, for instance, and you want to get the full-blast stereo signal before it gets lost into that low-pass filter de-emphasis network, then sampling directly at the discriminator is a good thing to do. Now you've got to be able to sample. You want to sample in a way that doesn't disturb the normal operation. I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to make a guess. I'm going to guess that the output impedance of the discriminator might be 600 ohms. And therefore, if I created a loading of 600 ohms at that point with my extra network that I'm adding, I would get roughly half the normal amount of audio power coming out of the discriminator. And there's some chance that my discriminator with that extra loading will not be as linear. It may develop some kind of distortion. So you would like the sampling network to not disturb the normal operation of the discriminator. Therefore, one way to do that would be to simply couple with a resistor. Couple a resistor right at the discriminator output. Bring it with maybe a piece of coaxial cable over to your separate connector and make that resistor, let me pick a number, 10,000 ohms. If I put a 10,000 ohm resistor on the output of a discriminator as a sampling device, and if the discriminator had, let me pick a number, a 600 ohm native impedance to it, then I'm doing very little disturbance to it. And as long as the circuitry of my audio amplifier looking at the discriminator output has a reasonably high input impedance compared to 10,000 ohms, I'm doing a beautiful job of sampling. I'm getting sampling that is independent of frequency. In other words, I'm doing a broadband sampling characteristic, because that's what a resistor is. And now, by the way I study that signal, I can look at the DC component and find out if the FM signal I'm listening to is above or below center. The nice thing about a discriminator is that the carrier of the signal is high or low compared to the center of the district. The discriminator gives you a positive or negative DC output. So by looking at the DC, I know is the receiver centered. By looking at the audio with a high frequency amplifier, high impedance amplifier, like an operational amplifier, I've now got the non-filtered raw output of the discriminator, and I can do all kinds of things with that. So I would sample with a resistor. I wouldn't even use a coupling capacitor. On the outside of the receiver, if I don't want the DC component and I want to put in a coupling capacitor, how big a coupling capacitor I use is strictly a function of what is the input. output impedance of my audio amplifier that I put downrange. If my audio amplifier downrange, was a well-chosen 50 cent out of the bubble packs at Radio Shack. It was a 50 cent operational amplifier being used in the voltage follower mode with the input impedance is many mega ohms, but my coupling capacitor could be an extreme or coupling capacitor. Maybe a couple of hundred picofarad would be doing the job. So what size coupling capacitor I use downrange is strictly a function of where I want the lower roll-off frequency to be, which is a function of what is the input impedance of the next stage of amplification, because that CR network, in other words, the coupling capacitor, into the input impedance, which is the transistor to the ground of the operational amplifier, in my example, that's what sets the lower roll-off frequency of that capacitor coupling network. So I would do it with a resistor, John. That's the simplest way, that's least invasive, in my opinion. If you want to be less invasive, use a 20K resistor instead of a 10K resistor, but I think you see the principle. KC2, WGV, K2LIW, and the tech man. And 2EL. Go ahead, Bill Rich.
All right, wait for the RG. Yeah, you know, that's a good, when I was running passive radio back in the 80s, I did just that. And I don't remember what size resistor I used. I think I went into the mega ohm, but it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't really matter, because worst case, if you short the resistor on the far end, you're not going to do any damage with that type of isolation, and the current through the resistor is minute. So even a large resistor, you're not going to get much of a voltage drop. It's a good way to do it. But I was going to comment that is an excellent pickle point for 9600 watt packet radio. Because you don't want to go through the audio stages, the emphasis on, you can get away with it on 1200 watt. It works even better for 1200 watt packets. It's certainly a plus to the high speed 9600. Back to that, that's who we are.
Know the exact frequency of your signal that you care about. Maybe you care about the 67 AC subcarrier, which is the stereo subcarrier, or the USAC. If you know the exact frequency that you care about, that network of resistor and or capacitors that you put as a sampler could be designed to emphasize that frequency and de-emphasize all of the others. Straight toward you, if you know what I mean. So once you know how to do sampling, there's a whole art and science of doing sampling, whether you're doing signal tracing on a receiver, like quite often I have put a 10K resistor in series with the scope probe semiconductor on an oscilloscope. As I'm going down the receiver chain and I'm doing signal tracing and I'm watching the signal get stronger and stronger as I go further downrange, by having a 10K series resistor on the oscilloscope, I'm doing very little disturbance of the circuits that I'm touching. And even if I touch a high voltage by mistake, nothing bad happens. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the tech man.
KC2 WGB. Excellent point, Dick, because I believe that's exactly what he's going to do with this. I think he's going to use that as an oscilloscope sampling port and 10-20K resistor. No problem with the impedance input of the oscilloscope. He will get a beautiful waveform, and he'll be able to parse out frequencies. I think he'll have a lot of fun with that. That's about it from Mel's mailbag. Back to you. Any other comments?
Hey, okay, I don't seem to hear anyone else with any questions on these subjects. Let's go over to Paul, the US2N. I think something interesting is about to happen in about 3 hours from now, Paul. Is NASA doing anything interesting? Is $2.5 billion online here at risk? 7 seconds of terror. Give us some wisdom, Paul, and tell us your favorite frequency. I'd like to believe that many starting at 1 o'clock or so, I'm going to be covering this event here. Beautiful, large surface laboratory called the Curiosity. 2,000 pounds of hardware. It's about to soften land on Mars. At the same time, it is moving 13,000 miles an hour toward Mars. Once it hits that atmosphere, 7 minutes, it's got to be brought to a stop, a very controlled stop. The direct to weather and telephone impact is just to ride against the shadow.
Okay, so no, nothing this week, back to you. Just kidding, Dick. But 8 years ago, we started talking about this when spirit and atmosphere in 1904. Dick, sorry, it was. MSL, Mars Science Laboratory Project now called Curiosity. This thing is about to land, like you said, launched back in November of last year. And it's got to slow down from 13,000 miles an hour down to 1.7, I think it's the number, 1.7 miles per hour. 1.7 feet, I think. It's going to land as well. It's a fun thing, but it'll be 700 pounds when it lands on Mars with the gravity. So it's got to slow down. Even so, Mars has an atmosphere of about 1/100 of what we have. Slow this thing down. It don't have to do a lot of work to drop it. That's a heat shield. It's going to heat up to 1,600 degrees as this thing comes through. It's got antennas pointing one back toward Earth, directly to Deep Space Network, and then it's got a UHF that's coming off around that. That will be picked up by two orbiting satellites. Send all this information back as it goes through. Thing heats up after getting to a certain point. Still faster than the speed of sound. You've got to open up the parachute to float. That parachute weighs about 100 pounds. You just have to be able to stand over 50,000 pounds force. And the thing will drop even further. The parachute now has to get out of the way so that top shell will separate, and now you've got this thing coming down with a bunch of rockets. It's like 8 rockets that will be firing to slow it down further. It does have to maneuver its way out of the way of the parachute drop. And then after a while, you get a little closer to Earth. The bottom shell has to pop off. With that, you've got radar coming out. It will be able to know how far it is away from the ground. And now you've got cameras to take pictures on the way down for later viewing. So you see the area that the thing landed in. That thing is going to start coming on. And then as you get closer to the ground, there's dust coming up. 8 rockets, eventually will be 4 rockets, but it'll cut back. But, situation where, you'd like to land this thing directly on the ground, but because of all the dust that starts shooting up, that wouldn't be any good for the equipment. It's $2.5 billion piece of equipment. So they use the sky crane on a nylon cable, and that's going to drop below the sky crane. Rocket is going to land on the planet Mars. With that, I was expecting to go off at
landing site. I believe this thing's sitting on a planet. Hopefully all goes well. We've got all these cameras on board. Over a dozen cameras. But you're not going to see pictures like right away, but soon after. They've got hazard cameras located in 8 of them around the bottom of Curiosity. The other first pictures that'll come back. A couple in the front, a couple in the back. They've got deer covers on, duck covers. What'll happen is those covers will pop off. And they'll be able to start taking black and white pictures of the surrounding area. See where this thing is sitting, what kind of tilt it's on. And they just get clear dust covers. Found out the reason for that is, you know, they're spring loaded. So, well, suppose they spring clip them, pop open, and get stuck on there, they won't be able to see. Well, at least they'll be able to see, you know, not as good, but through a clear cover. So they've thought of everything with this, especially with cameras. You won't get any real detailed pictures, you know, color panorama pictures for at least probably about 3 days. You've got aided hazard cameras. You've got a camera located on the arm. You know, the arm is going to come up, and that's got all kinds of digging equipment and drills. And also, it's got cameras on board, similar to what Curiosity and Spirit had, but it's more modern. And that'll be the next picture that they use. They'll be able to actually take a picture from the side of it. This thing without even moving the arm, and they'll be able to see what's near them and what's far away. There's a telescopic lens on that. Anything that they want to do, they'll take a look at that. And they're doing all this before they raise the mast. They won't raise that mast maybe for a day or two. And once the mast comes up, that thing has cameras, of course, on board that. Well, these are all stereo cameras, so they can see everything in 3D. All of the ones I mentioned. Once on a mast, they're going to come up. You've got four navigation cameras on board that. I think they're black and white, so I'm not sure. I think they're black and white, so they'll be able to see where they're going and drop it. Find this out yet? WSLN Space Report. These four cameras are used for navigation, but then you've got your two main high-resolution cameras, also on that mast. They call it the right mast camera and the left mast camera. And they're the ones that will eventually just get fantastic pictures back. They'll have panoramas, 360. Of course, the cameras can go up and down. They'll be able to look up at the mountain that they landed in. Well, they're landing in a scale crater, like a gigantic crater. And they're in like a valley of this crater, but yet in the center of this crater is this high mountain, and that's what they're going to be investigating first. Hopefully they land within this 12-mile spot, this little footprint that they've got figured out where they want to be, and they'll see what happens. It's designed to go for 2 years. Now, you remember Spirit and Opportunity was supposed to go for 3 months. And I think they said 20 or 25 times more. That was back in 04. Here's one of them, Opportunity, still running. Spirit quit back in 2010 in March. Opportunity, so no, their solar panels powered problems at night. Got a radio isotope, thermoelectric generator on board, similar to a deep space mission. It will not only give plenty of power to these four big batteries on board, like 45 amp hour batteries or something like that. Supply constant supply of power to the batteries. You're going to take the heat off of these plutonium pile that they have on you. Any excess heat, you know, they have like a little accumulator. So that's a rough idea of what's happening with Mars Curiosity. And it's going to be a lot of fun. A couple of hours from now, after the net, 1:30, 1 in the morning, you asked about where to watch it. I'm gonna guess that a lot of TV stations will probably cover it. Certainly CNN, probably Fox News, of course, and I think all your local stations as well. I heard that the big TV screen in Times Square is gonna have information, you know, about the landing, probably all these, especially what it would actually look like if it's going down. So a lot of places, of course, on the radio dials, you're gonna have information in. On a computer, it's usually the best place. So that's where I usually get on. Can be very crowded tonight, so I'll leave that on early. www.nasa.gov/NTV. November Tango Victor. www.nasa.gov/NTV. We'll get you directly to there. You can get it by going to NASA.gov. The homepage comes up. Look at the TV section. And click on that. If you click on three different things, because you wind up clicking on the schedule instead of this, next thing you know, where did I hit? I got on too late. Too many people are watching this thing. And you know, just go to this website and, you know, your TV will come up. All you have to do is click in the little square and whatever NASA is showing, that's what you'll see. So that's the best way. That's pretty much it. I got other reports on other things to do with space, but back to you, Dick, WS1.
Other research, I know what you're saying, yeah.
And what are they showing you there, Sean?
They're showing you some previous videos of some of the field trips and things like that, but it's gorgeous pictures, and I've used this app a couple of times, so you should set it up. Paul is right, let's get over on the side.
So I guess the recommendation is to find an early before it gets saturated. One of the chief scientists on Spirit and Opportunity was Steve Squires of Cornell University, I think it is. And I think you said the main scientist, Flip, one of the key guys on Curiosity, question number one. Question number two, I believe that parachute, when it opens, he said it's going to take 60,000 pounds of force. I've heard tell that that is the largest, heaviest, supersonic parachute that's going to be hitting at supersonic speed of acceleration. It's only 1,000 pounds of lift on that parachute. 1,000 pounds of spacecraft, 60,000 pounds of force, 60 g's of acceleration. That's a healthy amount of supersonic acceleration going on there, Paul. So, thank you for some comments on any of the above. WS2N, K2LIW.
Now all these space pieces, parts, cameras, they go through all these different tests before they go up. They've got to be able to test the G-test, the amount of takeoff, the acceleration. So I haven't heard what the G rating is for the acceleration of this thing, but go from 30,000 miles an hour down to zero in 7-8 minutes. That's quite a bit. But, that's supersonic speed, they tested this parachute more than any other parachute ever. So, let's keep your fingers crossed. Without that, they're in big trouble. Or I think the rocket will be able to slow it down enough to do its job. You got three ways to slow it down. Well, you've got the shield. You've got the parachute, you've got all these rockets. Steve Squires, I don't know if he's directly involved anymore. Involved with the NEMO project. stuff on the, been on the water with NASA as an aquanaut for a while, a couple of missions. The other guy, his name is Pete Stavanger, I think it is. Older than Steve Squires. He was the main guy. He's still with us. As far as I know, about a year ago, he had a report. He's the main guy. Now, transmission-wise, that's him on most of the time. And they've got two signals coming out of the top of the thing as it's going down through the atmosphere. They've got an X-band, I believe an X-band coming back, and they've got UHF going out at the same time, down right down the middle of it. You've got they put the X-band directly on the Earth, so it's like a real pencil sharp signal coming all the way back to the deep space network. And then you've got the UHF system coming out from that. And that's around 70 centimeters, around 400 megahertz. So you got direct contact with the main information, what they really wanted from the so-called repeated satellites around Mars. They're going to utilize two of them. They've got Mars Laboratory. It's going to be MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And then we'll also communicate with Odyssey. Odyssey is down there, 2001, polar orbit. And Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been up there, I guess 6, 7, 8 years now. So you've got one on a descending path and one on an ascending path, so that the folks don't have to one another at this point. And they reposition Odyssey to make sure it was in the right spot, put it to a higher orbit when Curiosity comes over. Because what they want to do is drop it. Not only the X signal coming back directly from Earth, so you get around that, coming out of the back, but you know, coming in that same, pretty much directional. There won't be any use going down, something there to receive it, but going up is what they want to do. The UHF signal will be going out pretty much in the same direction as X band. And as Mars Odyssey comes around, coming down, it will pass, Curiosity as it goes below it. And as it comes into the wake of UHF signal, it starts to pass the signal. It's going to get all the telemetry and information directly from Curiosity. And at the same time, you've got Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter coming around the other way. That will be picking up the signal. So what will happen is, obviously, we'll transmit live back to Earth. And this thing, MRO, will be taking the information and transmitting it back later on in the mission. Picture information, I remember John asked if there's going to be pictures on the way down. Well, yeah, once that bottom shield separates, they have a camera, so they're taking pictures down below. Well, that information will be transmitted back up to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. By the way, that's the size of a puzzle. It's a big freaking thing up there. And that's a big receiver. And it also has a camera on board for the high rise on the spacecraft. And as this thing is going down it will be taking pictures looking for the spacecraft as it's going into the atmosphere. And when the parachute opens up, it will be able to see that, hopefully, and store images in the computer when it comes around again around Mars. We'll send a signal back to Earth for the space network at the time of landing. And then the UHF signal directly from Odyssey. That'll be a repeated system. I hope I got that right. Back to WSDS.
Very nice information, Paul. 13,000 miles an hour is the speed at which it's going to encounter the atmosphere, being pulled in by Mars gravity plus its own speed it had before it got into the vicinity of Mars. 13,000 miles an hour is around 19,000 feet per second. A little bit shy of 4 miles per second is the speed at which it encountered. 19,000 feet per second, and in 7 minutes, which is 6 times 7, 420 seconds. 420 seconds, it's going to go down from 19,000 feet per second to something near zero. That's a 45-to-1 ratio. So in other words, over the whole 7 minutes, the average deceleration is 45 feet per second squared. That's around 1.5 g. So it's an average. Obviously, when you first open that parachute, that shock is going to be something like 30 to 60 g's. And you got to worry. You got to worry about, is that going to ripple up and get damaged? And is that g shock going to do any damage to the equipment on board? And you heard 76 squibs. I heard 79. Doesn't matter. It's a lot of them. All of these pyrotechnic devices under computer control. By NASA, because the shield around Curiosity has a strong similarity to what you and I would call the Apollo Command Module, the newest version of it. The Command Module is a cone-shaped object. There is a radio detector on the Curiosity. So as it was traveling through space, they ran that radiation detector, and so now an astronaut on his way to Mars, if there was one, would be behind a kind of capsule wall, very similar to the wall that Curiosity is behind right now, and so that radiation detector is located somewhat like where a human being would be located. There were 4 major solar events during this mission, and so they made some nice recordings of what the radiation looks like inside that spacecraft during those missions. And from that, you can make a judgment as to whether or not computer hardware was put at risk, whether or not a human being would be put at risk, and so on. So there's an article you can go to that gives you that information. So lots of brand new measurements are being made by Curiosity. Quite a few of them have never been made before. The one main thing that I'm missing, which only has qualitative interest, not quantitative interest, but I wish there was a audio microphone on board, because we know that the wind, although it's only a 1% wind density compared, an air density on Mars compared to Earth, still we know that that wind occasionally moves at 240 miles an hour, some crazy number like that. I'd love to hear what a microphone sounds like at 240 mile an hour wind. That's 1% of the density of the sea level air on Earth.
Nick, I heard last night that they are going to, there is a microphone on that thing.
Give us a few words on that. Go ahead, Barry. Give us a few words on that. Where did you hear it? Is it a documented source? Traceable to the Bureau?
Yes. It was something, it was on the news last night. There were, you know, actually, it was on NASA's website. That's where it was. On NASA's website last night, I was looking at this program, which I'm looking at right now, by the way, and they said that they didn't say much about it, but they were discussing sounds on Mars. That there could be sounds on Mars, a very thin atmosphere, but they will have it, and they do have something to sense it.
Well done.
Now, if it's a real microphone, even though the air density is 100 to 1 lower than ours, at 200 miles an hour, you've got on the ear whistling of wind. So are they going to hear something? If there's a real microphone there, I'd say, hell yeah, you're going to hear something. And that whistling wind would have to be interesting. And to listen to the way the wind whistles as you move the vehicle and make a 360-degree turn with the wind, guarantee the wind whistle is going to say, it's going to give you different pitches and different sounds, if you know what I mean. Give you a little bit of a feeling of what it's like to be there. So if you've got a stereo, high-resolution color picture of the terrain around you, and if you've got sound of the terrain around you and you can marry the two, that's one-third as good as being there, as I see it. I know I would not volunteer for this mission. There are people who said they would do it in a heartbeat. I would not volunteer for this mission because I think the chances of getting there and getting back home alive are very slim from my point of view. Too many things that can go wrong. Maintaining a human being in space is a very difficult thing. We take for granted what this Earth supplies us, continuous air pressure, continuous supply of solids, liquids, and gases, 14,000 pounds of air goes into your lungs once a year. 14,000 pounds of air comes back out of your lungs in one year. That's just air. And lots of fluids and lots of solids. All of that Mother Nature recycles every single molecule. Every time you take a breath, some of those molecules of that air were once inside the lungs of every other human being that has ever walked this planet, even thousands of years ago. So it's all recycled. To do that on board a spacecraft, wow, that... one of the other things that I saw in one of the pictures of Paul, you might want to comment on this one, is that the spacecraft knows that it wants to land right alongside of the Gale Crater. It wants to land in Gale Crater. So therefore, as it's going through the atmosphere with its heat shield, depending on how you tilt the spacecraft, you're doing a kind of surfing, three-dimensional surfing. So you've got rockets on board that can do reorientation of the spacecraft, spin and reorient the spacecraft so that it does surfing through the air to increase its accuracy of landing at that specific point it wants to land on Gale Crater. And I guess they've got a target that's, a couple of hundred square foot, an ellipse of a couple of hundred square foot, here we go. I'm going to guess a couple of hundred linear feet is the maximum dimension of that ellipse of intended landing spot. Is some of that true on my guesses, Paul, of US2M, K2LIW?
Yeah, the footprint is in miles, though. It used to be 12 by 8. Now they've got it down to, eight by four, something like that. They cut it back like roughly half, talking about miles. And they didn't do the last maneuver. They have a series of about 8 maneuvers that they do where after launch, and I think they've done away with at least 3 or 4. But they get stuff right on target. And yeah, they have the maneuvering jets that are going to be coming out. Who knows where it is? You know, it's going to have these weights that'll come off. It'll throw it one way or the other. And actually, the weight will separate from the sides of the spacecraft. And, it's going to do all this calculations as it comes down. And yeah, Gale Crater is a big crater. They figure a big crater and then put like a little mountain in the middle of it. Basically, what it looks like. It's not terribly steep. I mean, after they finish with it, they'll be able to drive out. This is a 2-year mission. So if they stay there, I don't know how long they'll stay there. That's probably for a very long time. It's a big area to cover. They'll go up and down. And the deeper you go, the more information you're going to be getting. So it looks like if they're at the bottom of this thing, SAM on board the system. They're going to analyze all the material that they bring up and put in. So I heat it all up, very high temperature, ionize, you know, some of the gas is going to go one way. Material's going to...
plan on eventually having manned missions by 2015, some of these groups. I'd like to see that, you know, paying $50 million of less, or $50 million I think they're up to now, but put one astronaut into back to the International Space Station with the Russians. This is a steep price to pay. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
I thought it was like $20 million to go to Soyuz one of those. I can't hear the name of the Russian space station. What's your best MP? Okay, what's the name of the one that it used to be $20 million to go there, Paul?
Yeah, that would be all numbers. People paid. You know, you had guys like Dennis Tito, first guy to be a tourist, went up to the space station. I think he paid around $20 million. But they charge the United States. You know, I think we're last time I read it was $50 or $60 million. I don't know, some number like that. That's not written in granite, though.
I've got the name of the Soviet space station. Soyuz is the vehicle that got you there. And what was the name of the space station itself?
They had two generations of space stations. They had Salyut space stations. Salyut had the earlier numbers that failed, but Salyut 6 kind of lasted a little bit, not too good. Salyut 7 lasted a while. Then spacecraft up. In fact, one time they actually docked to one spacecraft, eventually undocked and went to the other spacecraft, all on one mission, the other space station, all on one mission. Those things have been different. They're defunct, and then you had the Mir space station, which lasted, what, I don't know, 10, 15 years or something. That was pride and joy. Mir meaning peace. Back to this.
And the chemical laboratory on Curiosity, I think you called it SAM, S-A-M. Any idea what that stands for?
Sample analyze material, I don't know. I forget the gold thing. SAM, I forgot. Out of my head. I got too many acronyms in my head with the landing.
And there's my next question, Paul. What's the best guess as to the local time of encountering Mars atmosphere, and 7 minutes after that it's supposed to be down to the surface? So in our time when we're watching, I think I heard you say 1:31 a.m. before. That might be landing time, and 7 minutes before that is that the atmosphere encountering time? WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, WS2N. 1:31 Eastern Standard Time. That's what time was supposed to be at land. So I guess 7 minutes before that. And then you're going to have some time afterwards. I mean, they'll know right away that they're sending out a stream of pulses to Deep Space Network. So, but then if you've got your main information going up to Odyssey, spacecraft, that's the one that's in orbit, and that'll be sending, that's like a repeated, that'll be sending UHF information directly back to Earth, and that will really let us know if it all went well. And I think 2 hours after, we have to wait for the planet to rotate again, for the spacecraft to rotate again, roughly about 2 hours after that, you'll start to see your first pictures from the cameras located on the bottom of the spacecraft. You've got 8 of them, the ones I mentioned earlier. And they'll be sending the, I think they had a hazard. Yeah, they had the cameras on. And then the ones on the top of the navigation camera. So you get the hazard black and white pictures back first in a couple of hours.
The Mars Recurrence, MRO, Mars, Mars Recurrent Orbiter, that's not the right word for it,
reconnaissance.
Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Odyssey. Does each one of them go around the planet roughly once in 2 hours, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's similar to Earth. It's about an hour and a half, a little longer, maybe probably 2 hours. Yeah, that's about it. They're both in polar orbit.
So therefore, they sweep over the spacecraft, so to speak, roughly every 2 hours, up to the point where Mars does a significant amount of rotating. And Mars itself rotates a little bit more than a 24-hour day. So I guess it's going to be in view of the crater itself, Gale Crater. Any idea roughly how close it is to the equator of Mars, Paul? Go ahead.
I think it was pretty close. I think I read 4 degrees. 4 degrees south. Similar to where Spirit is. Not too far from that, you know. I mean, it's not going to go visit Spirit. Probably, you know, 1,000 miles away, but sort of in that quadrant, the opposite side of the planet, you've got Opportunity. That one's still crawling around. You know, I mean, but these two to ever meet up, I guess, that would probably take, I don't know, 50 years to expect you to.
Can you imagine if it was possible to steer Curiosity over to Spirit, pick it up out of the sand, dust it off, and say, go ahead, start doing your thing? I know that's out of the question, but wouldn't that be fun? I think you said there's 1,000 miles between the two. Out of the question.
I thought of that. But the, get the dust off, you know, something, rub the dust off the panel, too, you know, bring the power back, get it out of the stuck position. Maybe try to fix the wheel. But, I don't know, it looks like about it. Less than an eighth. Cut up the planet, you know, not in half, not a quarter, but maybe an eighth. How many miles in diameter? Wait, what's the... I'm trying to remember. What the circumference is of Mars? And I would say 1/8 of that.
Yeah, the circumference is around 12,000 miles. So, around 1,500 miles, out of the question. Spirit and Opportunity, that maximum distance was what? 10 miles or something like that, Paul?
I think they together they've done about 25. I think that was the last time I read Opportunity. I think it was, of course, that one's still going. I think that was at least 17. It's gone to a couple of craters, Victoria crater, and now it's at Endurance crater, which is a big crater. And the other one, Spirit, that was kind of landed in the middle of nowhere. It took months and months before they got that up Columbia Hill. So it really drove up a mountain, you know. And then was able to get those great panoramic shots. But on the way, the wheel was broken, and meanwhile it was dragging in the dirt. It stopped it once in a while, looked back, and realized that what they were looking at was real evidence was that the area was really flooded with water at one time. So it actually made a lot of good discoveries with its broken wheel and its traveling in real far distance to Columbia Hills to get up those mountains. But let's see what this one does. Two year rating time. Let's cut it down first. After that, let's see how long it's going to last.
Now, Spirit has a stuck wheel, got itself into deep sand, and couldn't get out. My question is, does Opportunity have all 6 wheels still turning smoothly? I am guessing that Spirit got some very fine dust in the bearings of that wheel and jammed it up. So hopefully Opportunity hasn't found any really fine dust and has better seals to keep out the sand. These are some guesses on my part. Back to you, Paul. KQLAW.
heard the actual cause of why the wheel started to lock up. I mean, it was fine in the beginning, but as time went by, it would lock up. And they just drive it backwards and just drag along, you know. And, but it was, what's nice is that bogey design, six wheels, you know, that was four wheels. You got to do wouldn't be able to do what it did after that. I mean, it worked for years, like with a broken wheel. Four wheels, it would have had three. Now we got bogey design, really is a very good design. Started with Pathfinder back in 1996-97. Worked good on that microwave size Rover. And you do the size of a golf cart, worked very good. It's amazing. If you look at the wheels, the thing is, of course, the size of a small car. The wheels on opportunity of what, about a foot in the diameter. These things are about 33 inches diameter wheels. So there's a big difference, and it's really a big machine. And I like the nuclear power plant on board. You don't have to worry about day or night, hot or cold. How it does. It's got that laser on the board and it'll shoot 20, 30 feet away. Vaporized rock that has detected it and will be able to tell what it is from far away. Yeah. What a gadget.
Yeah, Paul, will it travel at night?
Yeah, no, I mean, will it actually travel? I guess they can drive it at night. You know, they program it. Daytime, you know, they'll get all the pictures of what they need. They send the information up. I haven't heard that they will do it, but I don't see any reason why they couldn't. By the way, Barry, they had a microphone on something called a Mars Polar Lander, which was a debunked crash vehicle that didn't work out. That's the one that they fouled up with. American measurements and the metric story. That's the story. I don't know if I have to believe that, but that one crashed. That did have a microphone on board. I hope you're right that this one does. I know they wanted to. I heard when the thing originally was going to go up, it was going to have a microphone, but I haven't heard anything since. So I hope you're right about that.
And now, also, why don't they travel at night? What would be the reason? Because everything I'm hearing, they say they're going to travel in the daytime, but they never said they're going to travel at night. I'm just curious why they wouldn't.
Did you have that, or an event begin by midnight? Does it have high and low headlight beams on the pole?
Yeah, well, that might be the only reason that, you know, if something does happen, you know, where's the problem? But I guess they could always wait till daytime to take the picture, but... I don't think they have lights on it. When it needed, you know, I mean, they see the rocks around where it's going to go. It's 10 feet this way, 20 feet that way, you know. And they say to send the signals up. It's all autonomous. It does have these hazard navigation cameras on board. So I guess they're seeing these rocks. As they come up to it, you know, a navigation camera, and autonomously will shut it down. We'll say, hey, we're going off a cliff, let's shut it down. So this sudden cliff that they didn't know about, which is hard to believe because they have beautiful pictures from the high-rise camera from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter of where this thing is going to be. But I guess for safety reasons, you know, I mean, cameras will see it's a problem. Shut itself down. I mean, there's no real-time operation with this. You can't say, oh my God, you know, stop, hit the, you know, pull out the safety release pin. This thing's about to go. It would be 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes late, up to 20 minutes later. Maybe for that reason, Barry.
Did I earlier hear somebody signing in KD2 Charlie something?
in with the question at the hospital.
Okay, so 1:31 a.m. is the landing time. 7 minutes before that, somewhere around 1:20-something, 1:24, I guess, encountered the atmosphere. I did that mathematics wrong. 1:23, 1:24, in that order. And hopefully lots of coverage on our news tonight, and www.nasa.gov/NTV, November Tango Victor. I guess that stands for NASA Television. Let's hope it goes well. Keep your fingers crossed. A lot riding on this one. What would you like to talk about, Paul? I mean, West and 2XJN, A2RIW.
Like 20 minutes ago, I have sent you a PDF with WinCare automatic modulation meter for AMM257. I wonder if you would be able to open it.
You might want to quote DirecTV or their 800.